Welcome to another episode of At the Table with Patrick Lencioni, where everything we talk about is related to organizational health and the world of work. I'm Pat Lencioni, your host, joined by the full crew today. Cody, Bo, and Tracy, all together now. One, two, three. How are you guys?
Wonderful.
Awesome.
Swell.
You're supposed to go all at once. It's supposed to be just one cacophony.
We need to better coordinate.
Okay, very good, though. I'm glad you're all doing well, though. Matt's behind the glass, keeping us on track. Karen is back. She's back, and she's helping me out. I've got a bunch of notes already from her, and she's going to be helping me. And so, this is going to be a really interesting podcast today. Cody, what's the topic?
The invisible threat.
Yeah, that's more the title than the topic, because it's hard to know how to describe this. The invisible threat. And here's what we're talking about. This came from a conversation we were having 3 hours ago. And I've been doing work in organizations for 27 years. This never occurred to me. And that is this. The reason why we have a culture, you know, we have values and behaviors and a culture. Our organization has a culture, but it exists within a larger culture. And the invisible threat is if we don't protect our culture, then the culture at large seeps into it, which can be either dangerous or generic. So what I've never really understood or considered was that every company exists in the culture at large, and it needs to define how it wants to be so that it doesn't get subsumed by that culture at large. And that's what we want to talk about today, is what punctures our culture and what the dangers of that are and how this plays out. And we're going to be talking about this largely for the first time.
And I would say, Pat, even in the midst of existing in the culture at large, all of these corporations, organizations exist in a sea of other companies that they, if they're not clear about what their culture are and they bump into another company in their same industry, we all have this sort of assimilation. If we're not on guard around that, we can go like, we should be more like them. And so that's part of the conversation here, is not just the external pressures of the society at large, but the pressures of other companies or competitors, or how do we guard against that?
Right. Cause that is part of the culture at large. Other companies, other ethos or issues that are floating around us. And our job is to protect our organization so it can be intentional about what it is and not get influenced by what the company down the street is doing. Or for that matter, even somewhat what some of our customers might be doing. We need to be true to who we are. And I've never considered the fact that that is under constant, maybe you might say passive threat. And if you're not really diligent about defending that, you're at risk.
Well, one of those threats is actually just internal, because we drive to work and we live outside of work, right? So we're aware of other cultures, other assumptions, other beliefs, other values. And sometimes it's tempting. Sometimes it's tempting, but well, that's what everybody else is doing. Everybody else is, you know, growing like crazy. Everybody else is, you know, well, one of our values is hungry. And I was thinking about how culture has become less hungry, right? Mm-hmm. It's harder and harder to find hungry people. And that could be tempting to sort of cheat on that value because it's what everybody else is doing, but it would weaken our culture.
Yeah, we don't live in a bubble. We don't go to work, stay at work. And thankfully, that would be a terrible thing, to live in a bubble. But each day we are being presented with ideas that don't necessarily correspond to with the culture we want. I mean, one of the biggest specific threats to our culture is the idea that people are like, you guys should grow faster. And we want to grow. We want to have impact. One of our strategic anchors is to have impact. But that doesn't mean maximize our revenue and maximize our growth every quarter. But that is very much an ethos that exists in corporate America, especially among public companies. And so people can say, you know, you could make more money if you did this. And sometimes we're like, gosh, I guess we could. We're like, oh, wait. No. That's not our culture. Okay. But every day you're being presented with options to kind of go generic or go meta culture. And that's a threat.
You know, normally, Pat, I wait till later in the podcast to give a bad analogy, but I'll try one up front here, which is my wife and I just went to a party of some friends of ours, and we're sort of the fringe friend in that friend group. So they had a bunch of their close friends at the party, and we were sort of the new people. And it was so funny. We went to the party, and everyone there was very sort of artsy and well-dressed and sort of fashion forward. And we are not that way. Lindsay, like you guys have named the last time you saw me not wearing the hat I'm wearing right now or the one pair of jeans that I own. But it was so interesting because we came back to sit in our house and Lindsay was like, oh man, all of those people are trendier. And it was almost exactly what you're describing. It was like, should we be more like them? Should we do a better job of like the way we present ourselves? And I was like, no, that's not who we are. You know? And so you can do that as an organization too. You can bump into a hyper growth company and go, that tells you, you guys should grow. And if you don't have a clear and clarified and codified culture, then there's a real good chance that you might get distracted or even not to even distracted, but enticed by that.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting. I think about the analogy of the fish that's swimming upstream. It's like, if you just float, if you don't have a clear culture and you're not reinforcing it and really with courage and intentionality, sticking to who you are, you will just float with the current. Mm-hmm. And you have to constantly remind yourself, this is what we believe. This is how we make decisions. This is who we are. And we're glad for that so that you can ward off those occasional or persistent threats that say, be like everybody else, go with the flow.
Mm-hmm. So Pat, can you describe why is this dangerous? I understand how you could become generic, but why specifically is this dangerous? That's a strong word.
Yeah, because the idea is any organization, any person has to stand for something. Mm-hmm. And the idea of letting others determine what you stand for seems to me like one of the most dangerous things in life. Like, mm-hmm. who are you? Oh, I don't know. Just watch TV or read the newspaper. Whatever's going on today, that's who I am. And we lose our identity. We lose sight of ourselves. We become not attractive. We become generic. And our companies, nobody really wants to work there because working there is just like working anywhere else. And mm-hmm. suddenly we become just a vanilla or gray entity that seems to have lost its soul. So purposefully choose your values and then hold true to those so you can stand out. And from a business standpoint, that's about success and strategy. It's like being intentional and differentiated from others. Mm-hmm. So I think that's now what's very interesting about all this is the concept of if you're a public company, and I never really thought about it this way, but if you're a public company, you have a huge puncture wound in your culture. And that is by definition, you have shareholders who didn't get chosen because they agree with your values necessarily. They purchased your stock and they have an avenue for influencing your operations and your culture. And so the danger of being a public company is you're constantly dealing with this influx of influence, if you will, and it's not necessarily consistent with the kind of company you want to be. So it's one of the reasons why I really get sad when I hear companies IPO. Some need to do it because you have to have capital to grow. But sometimes I'm thinking, why are you going public? And they're like, well, you get a lot of money from that. And I'm like, yeah, but you really risk losing your soul sometimes.
I like this idea of these potential puncture wounds. And what could happen is somebody could wake up in a culture, in a company culture they've been in for years, and all of a sudden realize it's unfamiliar to them because the cultural values changed. Pat, what are some of the other potential puncture wounds? You mentioned being a public company. You mentioned maybe like a desire for growth might be one. What would be some others? Well,
I think the desire for growth is actually more of an example of that. I think the puncture wounds themselves are sometimes if the leader has a crisis and doesn't really know who he or she is and doesn't keep leading the leadership team according to the values and gets distracted by other needs they have in life. I mean, you think about like a midlife crisis. I used to say, if I showed up to work and you guys saw me downstairs and I had a girlfriend and a Porsche convertible, it's like, oh no, you know, run for the hills. So sometimes a leader actually goes through a crisis in life. And so they stop protecting the culture and they're letting new things in. Mm-hmm. A big one, and Matt was telling us about this before, is hiring. If you start hiring people that don't meet your values, that's a huge puncture wound. Or if like you acquire a company that doesn't meet your culture, or you tolerate people that are in your company that don't really vibe with the culture and with the values, those are all potential points of infection, you know? And the only vitamin C is sometimes even the physical environment can be a potential puncture. Like we work in a world where everybody's working from their home, let's say, which I don't love. And they don't get to be in an office with other people where they're constantly reinforcing one another and constantly reminding each other. So you're sitting in your living room, you're doing your work, and you're watching a little TV, and you're hearing the news, and people come over, and you're dealing with people. You have very few coworkers reinforcing the company values, and it's easy to kind of forget, you know, what you're all about.
Yeah, I think all of those are worth diving into a little bit, Pat, but I want to go back to the very first one that you said, the sort of the leader drift idea, because it'd almost be easier to spot if it were you squealing into the parking lot in a Porsche or leaders squealing into the parking lot in a new car. It's actually far more subtle than that, but just as dangerous. When you wrote an article a little while ago called The Eyes of the Leader, and it was sort of like the idea that it's probably not going to play out as a Porsche squealing into the parking lot. It's more likely to play out that the leader really cared about the culture, and that was the single knew that that was their singular job, is to be the carrier of that culture, and some new opportunity or new acquisition or new something else came into the picture, and they drifted, their eyes drifted. So I think that happens very often when you're talking about these puncture wounds.
Yeah, and just to be fair to the people that like Porsches, the girlfriend in the Porsche was probably a bigger indication than the car itself, because plenty of people drive those. It was the girlfriend. We got to put that in there. That would be the really scary thing. But yeah, when the leader loses sight of what's important and starts to get distracted, I've seen a really good company where the leader just got bored with the core business and started pursuing other interests. And pretty soon that's what they talked about during their meetings. And it really opened up the company to kind of drift. The biggest problem with that drift was initially it didn't actually hurt the bottom line. It was actually fine. It might have even helped it. But the question was, did they do that at the expense of their soul, the expense of their culture? And that's not something that plays out in days and weeks. It plays out in months and years.
I'm thinking about that old saying, you know, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. And I wonder if what can happen is as leaders get successful and they maybe get invited into more, you know, gatherings or conferences, then they start getting the attention of people who have different values than they do.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it comes down to, Bo, who are they trying to please? Are you trying to please the outsiders? Or are you trying to please the customers that buy into what your business is all about and the employees that are totally committed to doing that? And the vendors that want to work with you because they like that too. That has to be your audience, and customers are a part of that. But when you start wanting to please analysts or to impress people that aren't impressed by what you were before, when you lose sight and you get bored with what you do, that really opens you up to that threat. That's a really good point.
I'll even say, you know, Pat, this conversation reminds me of one of the core tenets of your book, The Motive, which is when you're a responsibility-centered leader, part of the leader's job is not just to keep their eye on the ball, like we just talked about, but the constantly reminding, this chief reminding officer part of this. And so many leaders get bored with the message or bored with the core business and think, I should move on to the next thing. And the right motive for leading will prevent you from doing that. And so even going back to like, why am I in this position? How am I serving my own constituents, the people at this company, I think can help puncture proof that for you.
Absolutely. That's a really good point, because you have to purify your intentions and say, what am I trying to do? I think this is, and it can seem benign at first, like the little signs that the leader's losing interest in the core business or losing interest in their, what else do I, I'm looking for something more. So that's when their motive shifts from serving their employees, their customers, and the core to being rewarded by others. And I think it would be a heroic thing for a leader to say, hey, you know something? I think I've lost my interest in this. And I think I need to step out, because I would probably want to take this into a different direction purely for my entertainment or my benefit. And that would be at the expense of everyone else. And that's one of those things where a leader has to purify their intentions. They have to know when to walk away, because they're threatening the very viability of the culture, because they're no longer the same person they were before.
I want to bring up something I think Karen mentioned before the podcast that really resonated with me, which is sometimes this, the hunger to learn about culture and to be tempted to do what everybody else is doing, comes from a fear of being accused of being naive. And I really resonated with that. You can be accused of, oh, you're kind of simple, or that's naive, or that's just not the way the world is anymore. And I don't know if you have anything else you want to say about that, Pat. It just personally resonated with me.
No, I think it's, you got to love who you are. And when you choose that, choose it intentionally and accept that. And if Cody's friends go, dude, you've worn that shirt, you know, you have, what do you have, a, do you have a, four shirts in your rotation? Cody should go, no, there's five, but that's just about it. And I feel really good about that. And people are drawn to other people who actually lean into what they believe. And, mm-hmm. and when you try to be like everybody else, you actually become less attractive to the world. And so it's like In-N-Out Burger. We can't use them as our unpaid ad, but they are an unpaid ad right now. I remember I did a, I love In-N-Out Burger. I love, and we have a guy from Cuba in our office who people have heard, Joel, and he loves In-N-Out Burger, and he's been in the country for a very short period of time. He goes, gosh, the people they hire and the way they are. And I did a talk for them years ago, and I was like, hey, maybe you should add this to your menu. And they go, no, that's not who we are. And it's okay if, Pat, you like turkey and you're trying to be healthier. That's cool. But we're a hamburger company. And it's like, I love them. So whenever I want a hamburger, I go there because they're the best at that. But the rest of the world is constantly trying to be everything to all people. And they end up becoming nothing to no one.
Mm-hmm. Pat, you know, you just mentioned hiring. I think this is something that companies so often get wrong, and they don't give it enough credit. They're not worried enough about hiring the right people. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, what it comes down to is, and a public company struggles with this more because they're being told, like, you have to grow, you have to grow. But mm-hmm. if you can't find the right people to grow your business and you're not a public company, don't grow. Because you are just, you are creating a problem that's going to come, and it's going to be really, really bad. And mm-hmm. I really do think it's better to preserve your culture and grow organically in the right way than it is to lose your culture so that you can tell somebody that you're twice as big as we were 5 years ago, but we're mm-hmm. twice as miserable about working there because we don't really like seeing the cars in the parking lot when we arrive.
Yeah, Pat, as you're saying that, I was like, how refreshing would it be when you ask someone what they do and the answer was, I'm part of a intentionally slow growing startup. You know, everybody says I'm at a fast growing startup. You know, like that's the ubiquitous, I've been commandeered by this invisible threat. I have to say that we're fast growing. But it would be a uniquely refreshing thing to be able to say, actually, we're growing slowly, intentionally, with all the right people, and we'll grow at the rate that we find the resources and the human beings that belong here. That would be unbelievable.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's that's so true, Cody. Your favorite team in basketball was the Utah Jazz, and they never Correct. Won the championship. But darn it, they did it their way. And maybe they could have sold off their culture and got some players who didn't fit. But they actually just played the way they played. And I don't know at the end of the day if that's not actually more valuable. But what we're saying here, I want to be very clear, is we're not talking about good versus bad. Like the rest of the culture is always bad. It's just different. And so don't let a different culture invade yours. Sometimes there is bad things out there. There often are. But sometimes it's just that employee that you don't want in your company, they just don't belong there. They belong someplace else. So we're not trying to say keep the bad people out and only keep the good people. It just know what your culture is and then have the courage to say to somebody, I don't think you would thrive here, and I don't think it's the right place for you. That's much better than hiring the wrong person who's going to add much to your revenue, but then in the end, you're going to have to suffer for it.
That was the sweetest way ever of saying, yeah, the Jazz lost, but at least they were intentional about it. So thank you, Pat. That I feel great. I feel even better about my team.
Pat, as you talk about these invisible threats, what are some things a leader can do to protect against those threats?
I think they have to constantly talk about what their culture is, not just their values, but like, and how that plays out. I mean, we were just doing this. This is how this came up. We've had some people look at our business and say, gosh, you know, you guys could grow a lot faster. And they kind of were like, they were so kind, but it felt a little bit condescending, like, oh, you poor naive people, you should be maximizing your revenue around those things. And I was on a call with somebody about that, and Tracy and Karen both, they noticed that I got kind of agitated. Not, I was just kind of like stressed, and I didn't even know it. And afterward, we talked about it, and it was because I was like, oh my gosh, how come we're not doing this? Other people think we're missing something. And it was like, no, let's go back and who are we and how have we been from the beginning? What are we trying to achieve? And it's like, oh no, let's be grateful that we are the way we are so that we can say to that person, hey, thank you for that advice. That's great. But I think we're good. I think we're good. I think we're okay. And that's not rejecting them and saying, no, you're bad for thinking we should do that. They're just assuming that the culture says growth is always good. Bigger is always better. More money is better than less money. And that's not necessarily the way we look at things. One of our core values at our company is mission over money. And so when we get questioned, it's kind of good to go back and remind one another, hey, let's recommit to the mission. So I think it's talking about it, Bo, reminding ourselves. I think it's posting some things in your office so you can kind of be reminded even when you're not talking about it. I also think it's getting your people together and retelling the story constantly about how we came to be where we are. And Bo, I think you had a good story about a guy who sold his company, and it was very interesting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I remember hearing the story years ago. It really spoke to me. Somebody built a company, and then they got an opportunity to sell it, and they made more money than they ever imagined making selling their company. And they woke up 8 days later and realized, wait a minute, all I ever really wanted to do was to be with those people leading that company that I loved. And he went back and rebought the company from the group he had sold it to.
For the same price. He just basically said, I'd like it back. Here's my money.
And that probably, it's very likely that happened where a bunch of people said, hey, you're at a really good spot at the company. You should consider selling. And sometimes like those threats, those like potential penetrations of your culture is like they're just little, something might come up in a conversation. Somebody says it and then it's like a bug in your brain of like, oh, maybe I should think about that. Something you've never even considered before. And I love that guy had the courage to say, actually, that's not what I want. Even after he had made the sale. That's a great story.
Yeah, because he sold it for $100 million. This is not a small company. And he was I just sold my company for $100 million. And the whole world is like going, wow, one day I'd like to sell my company for $100 million. And he's like, but it was never about getting rich. I don't know what I want to do now. I liked the people. The gift of having that company is we were making something that customers like, that we love to work together. We got to see it play out. That was the gift. That was the culture. And we just let the outside world tell us what was most important.
Pat, I just want to emphasize one thing that you mentioned about ways to protect the culture that I think is sometimes overlooked, which is three-dimensional time. And I think when we're in a distributed world, when so much happens on Zoom, there is so much benefit to being face-to-face, to be around each other. Because the culture, doesn't it so much live in the people? And it does live in the physical environment that you're in, but being in the same physical environment, I think helps solidify our culture as a table group.
Yeah, I have to say, this is a slightly different topic, but it's related to this. I'm starting to get slightly more impatient when I meet companies that kind of brag about the fact that they don't make people come to work, even though it would be pretty easy for people to come in, at least for like 4 days a week. And they're like, yeah, we just kind of gave up on that and decided to let people do this. And there's a part of me that thinks that we're settling. I get the idea of a distributed company. I get the idea that people are in different places because we have to do that too. But whenever you can get people together, I think it's worth it. And I'm finding that I wonder if we aren't settling. And I'm really concerned that the economy is going to suffer because people say things like our productivity hasn't changed. And I want to say, can you show me how you know that? And it's usually a gut feel. They're like, I don't know. I think we're productive. And I'm really starting to get more and more concerned that what was a necessary thing or even sometimes a strategically good idea has now become a default because we don't want somebody to go, oh man, don't make me do that. And so I think that also it makes our culture more vulnerable because it's hard to have a culture when people aren't together. So it often comes down to courage. It often just comes down to having the courage to disappoint somebody in the short term. And they'll be thanking you in the long term for doing what matters.
And I would say, Pat, I don't even know if it's that ancillary to this discussion that we're having, because it seems pretty core to the nature of this podcast when we talk about human dignity and work and fulfilling work and being in person and having a culture that exists in, you know, in person. Like, it's not about, at the end of the day, measuring productivity. Productivity is probably a downstream measure of culture and thriving workplace and not a leading measure. It's probably a lagging measure versus a leading measure on that.
Absolutely. And when you finally get to the point where your culture is evaporating, it's so hard to put it back together. So be a little bit paranoid about the punctures in the culture wall. You know, put on the armor, make sure you protect that, because that you'll always be glad you did that. I really think that. All righty. Bo. Okay, Bo. You have the unpaid ad today, and it can't be for Porsche or for In-N-Out Burger. Wait, so what do you got,
Tracy,
for us?
You gave him this job back. He's back and he's reinstated. Okay.
Hey, if you're new to our podcast, we do this thing where we promote a business or a product that we like and we don't take any money for them. We call it the unpaid ad. And Cody's been really coming at me pretty hard at these unpaid ads. And Cody, I like you. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to sit here and, you know, pick a product you've never used, like shampoo or running shoes or something like that. Okay. But I am going to stick with the fast food theme and say, one of my all-time favorite desserts is the ice cream cone from McDonald's. McDonald's ice cream cone. I submit to you, it is the best fast food dessert. Discuss.
I notice what, you know, milkshakes, they don't call them milkshakes at McDonald's. They call them shakes because there's not milk in them. I'm wondering, is there milk in the ice cream cones? I think the answer is no.
That's probably why it's so good.
Did you get, like, is it vegetable ice cream, Bo? Is that an option for you?
I think that it is made from vegetables. That's how good it is.
Yeah, so I wonder, is it like a memory like Shamrock Shakes that we used to have when we were kids? I always say, oh, I love the Shamrock Shakes. And then you get one, you're like, oh, that's not so good. So is it really good quality? Or is it just, you know, you remember going through there and...
That is a great question. So we should do some scientific research and I should go today and find out. But the ice cream cone plus the french fries is pretty unbeatable, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I was kind of hoping one of you would vehemently disagree, but I just think it's fantastic.
I disagree. Sorry, Bo. I'm not an ice cream fan, but I can get on board with the french fries, but not the ice cream.
Yeah, and I don't want to slander McDonald's here. Maybe they have very milk-friendly, but really milky ice cream. So I don't know that for sure. I'm just curious as to how that plays out with the milkshake. There is here in Lafayette, California, still a McDonald's. And so we'll all have to go through the drive-thru one day and test it out and let you know how I think.
And obviously this feels like another personal attack because Bo knows I don't like dessert in general. And for some reason, with the Oxford comma, we got floods of emails of supporters for the Oxford comma. I got exactly zero emails for the documentary thing. I'm formally going to resign from the podcast if there's no support. No, I'm teasing. This has been a lot of fun.
We'll have to have a telethon. Save Cody's job. Tell him the documentaries are good. You know you're going to get some now.
I actually asked Matt. I said, hey, Matt, is the podcast inbox still operational? Is it disconnected? I haven't gotten any fan mail lately. And he said, yeah, it's working just fine. So
you've gotten all the fan mail. All righty. McDonald's ice cream. Give it a shot. Okay. And thanks for joining us at the table. Tell your friends, tell your family, please, go ahead and like it or whatever you do to it. Punch that button. No, it's not. We don't have one of those. You can just send a nice review if you want to. But more importantly, we just love you listening, and we look forward to talking to you next time on At the Table. God bless.